The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, everyone. It's John Pollock and waiting with you on Monday morning, May the 27th. Hello, Way. How are you?
How am I? What a question. It is 12:41 a.m. here on the East Eastern time zone. I find myself asking the question, what is wrestling? I found myself asking that a lot, especially during that last match. And I'm here to discuss it. I'm here to that match gave me like a very interesting, almost philosophical, like mindset about what even this all whole thing is, and what are we doing? Why are we here at 12:45 a.m. talking about it?
Because it's what we sat down at 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern time to start preparing to talk about it afterward. I will just get this out of the way right now, that if this card had been booked to open with Will Ospreay and Roderick Strong, fine, 17-minute opener, big surprise return of MJF for an angle afterwards, that's 45 minutes of the show right there. You throw me one other undercard match, and then you give me those final four matches, that's a 3.5-hour show. And I'm telling you, I would have been through the moon. Mm-hmm. This is a really, really long show. And I know people hate when I state that, but that's a lot of wrestling on this show. I am so glad I have notes here, because I would not even be able to remember what happened with the Bang Bang Gang and the Death Triangle 5 hours ago.
Yeah, the topic of like the length of these AEW pay-per-views has been a topic of discussion for the past 5 years. And this is the 5-year anniversary, essentially, of, I guess, this pay-per-view, if not even the entire company, if you want to call it that. This might have been like the longest one. Like, has there been a longer pay-per-view that they've done?
I'd have to look. I can't remember starting this late. This would probably, at worst, this would be right near the top, if not the latest.
So clearly for Tony Khan, like I don't sense this is any sort of like thing he's looking to change. He seemed perfectly happy with the run times of these shows, and we'll discuss how we felt the crowd might have responded to the length by the end of the show. Certainly I'm curious to know what some of the audience members felt in the chat room. Maybe we should mention off the top, because this is such a late show, we unfortunately won't be taking patron calls at the end of this.
Well, let's get into the show. It was at the MGM Grand Garden Arena. They had a pre-show with Renee, RJ City, and Jeff Jarrett. And we go to the first of two buy-in matches, Thunder Rosa against Deonna Purrazzo. And we had Thunder Rosa coming out, and she was wearing this kind of Elvis costume. And they explained she was wearing 21 crosses on her outfit in honor of the victims of the Uvalde, Texas shooting from 2 years. It would have been 2 years ago this past Friday that shooting took place. And I was glad that Excalibur made mention of that. And so pretty lively reaction when they started things off here. You had Purrazzo working over the arm of Rosa's, which was heavily taped up, and they do a double clothesline spot. Purrazzo then stops her on top into the Tree of Woe, and we have Deonna Purrazzo hitting into the crosshairs when there's a running elbow by Thunder Rosa, goes for the Tijuana bomb into a Fujiwara armbar, but then a backslide out, ground cobra by Thunder Rosa, and Deonna Purrazzo counters it by cradling her while grabbing the bottom rope for the heel victory in 10 minutes and 15 seconds.
Really good little match here. I thought, like, really good aggressive arm targeting from Purrazzo. Good selling from Rosa. Nice little technical finishing sequence here with Purrazzo countering Rosa's counter to Purrazzo's rope break. I think with Purrazzo cheating with the sneak pin, this certainly didn't feel like a definitive end. Like, it felt more like a first round victory rather than something conclusive. So if this was an attempt to maybe continue the feud, I thought it was pretty good. So I'm looking forward to it now that we've seen a glimpse of the chemistry between the two.
Yeah, I did enjoy the video package where we had comment from Deonna Purrazzo, where on Saturday's Collision, she said, "There's only one place to settle this. The bright lights and the biggest stage, double or nothing, buy-in." And then in the edited video, it was, "There's only one place to settle this. On the big stage, Las Vegas." And that we eliminated the buy-in as the biggest stage for these two. But yeah, I assume this this continues. Lexi Nair is with the Acclaimed and Daddy Ass, and just got a long promo from these three. Each of them took turns. Daddy Ass saying all three of them are who better than Brian Cage. Then Max Caster went on a long bit about he doesn't know the names of the Gates of Agony, and he is the best wrestler alive. Max Caster, the best wrestler alive. And they are going to lend their star power to the Cage of Agony, as they are being called. And then Bowen's just called Brian Cage a bitch. Renee welcomes out Martha Hart and Tony Khan, and they announced that this year for the Owen Hart Cup Foundation Tournament, the winners of the tournament, which will be decided in Calgary on July 10th, the winners will get title shots at Wembley Stadium. And I thought this could have waited until the day before in a press conference-like setting to announce that the winners of this tournament are getting title shots. I don't think you had to announce it so far out.
Yeah, sure, certainly. I mean, it's good stuff. It's exactly almost like what they're doing with King of the Ring. You're using the entire tournament to build to a main event of your big summer event. Makes all
and
the
it
sense
tells you
world.
All the big names are going to be in these tournaments. These are going to be it's setting up your biggest title match in theory of the year for Wembley Stadium. So you're going to have all the big guns in this tournament. In theory, you would hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think as an annual tradition at this point, it certainly adds a lot of, you know, reason for people to care about the Owen Hart Cup rather than just a belt or just sort of like a figurative, you know, award. This adds some real stakes to it, certainly.
Out came Chance, the Vegas Golden Knights mascot. This did happen on the show, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. It's a long time ago. The Acclaimed and Daddy Ass versus the Cage of Agony might be the worst switch of a name I can imagine. The Cage of Agony.
Yeah, Caster had a pretty good rap today where he basically made fun of it, saying that it sounded like a chastity belt.
Yes, and then Excalibur also noting that here in AEW, we do not kink shame. Which is quite a throwback, because that's how Gordon Soley used to open up Championship Wrestling from Florida as well. He also said that Brian Cage was cosplaying a top guy. And I don't know if you caught this, but Bowens did his Everybody Loves the Acclaim bit, and he's leaning against the barricade. And this girl in the front row hands him like this handmade letter with these flowers on it. And Bowens just is like, "What's this?" And he just like passes it to Billy Gunn and just like toss it away like garbage.
I did not notice, and if I did, I probably would have forgotten by this point.
Yeah, well, we will never know what was in that letter. We got like an unironic pose down between 40-year-old Brian Cage and 60-year-old Billy Gunn.
Yes, and who would you have awarded the winner?
It's close. I mean, the fact that Billy Gunn is debatable with Brian Cage tells you many things. And then Billy Gunn told him to suck it. And Daddy Magic gets a kick out of Billy Gunn just like screaming about his genitals on live pay-per-view or television.
The man has made a great career out of talking about his body parts. Yes.
Yeah. Well, Bowens was looking like one of his former stablemates because his quad was completely taped up here. And they did work on it and attacked it with the steps. Billy Gunn, of course, is the one to get the hot tag to lift the sails of his team when they're down. Hits the one and only to Khan, and then Toa cuts him off. They hit a triple powerbomb onto Gunn. Bowen is in for the save, and then they have a chair when Chance the mascot rips the chair away. So we're going to have to do a who did it better this weekend, Chance the mascot or Ibrahim Alajaj?
Shall I make a poll for the YouTube?
Perhaps you should. They both tore the house down. And then Gunn uses a small package to pin Khan in 11 minutes and 45 seconds. The Acclaimed Daddy Ass and Chance, the mascot, pose in the ring.
Yes. I thought the spot where they injured Bowen's leg was well done on the floor. The rest of the match I just kind of felt was okay. I think Cage of Agony, what did they call them? What are they? What
they call them?
Agony?
Nothing. They're nameless.
No, well, the Cage of Agony. But what? Sorry, what's the tag team's name again? I forget.
The Gates of Agony.
Gates of Agony. Thank you so much. I get them confused with the Final Testament and the Authors of Pain. Like, they all exist in this sort of vacuum, this black hole I have for like teams I just don't really give a shit about. Now, I think they're a very good team, you know, especially with Brian Cage, Cage of Agony. They're really a great team in Ring of Monsters, but by this point, you heard this crowd chant, "What's your name?" You know, their value is so low, they're booked so poorly that they're just kind of tough to take seriously, no matter how good they might look in ring. I also hope that, like, these crowd chants are like a sign to AEW that they should really work on giving these guys some actual storyline and some actual personality by this point. They've lost Nana. You know, what chance did these guys have? And I'm not talking about the mascot. Maybe they should have the mascot.
Well, I mean, they're just happy that no one is singing Nana, Nana towards these guys at this point in their juncture. But hey, they'll take the, what's your name gimmick. I mean, this is the most over they've been. Talented team, too. I really like Toa, especially. But they're very, they were very nondescript here. That was your buy-in show.
It's affected my enjoyment of their in-ring performances. I agree with you. They're great. But like, without any like status, without any real significant booking or personality, it's really hard to take them seriously.
Well, maybe they just needed this new team name, and it's going to take them to the next level. Yeah. On to the pay-per-view itself, and Roderick Strong, Will Ospreay opens the show. Huge reaction in particular for Will Ospreay, and we have Don Callis on commentary, and he's selling the belt shot from Wednesday with a bandage on his head. And Ospreay just immediately slides into the ring during Strong's entrance and goes for the hidden blade, and things begin with Taven and Bennett getting involved and tossed into the timekeeper's area. And Bennett lifts up Ospreay onto his shoulders, and Taven goes for a dive over the top for a doomsday device. He nearly didn't clear the top rope, and they just go down here, and it looked like Taven like killed himself coming down here, and they rotated Will Ospreay. So that was to get the heat on Roderick Strong, who took over from this part.
I really did not like this spot. I mean, for one thing, it was unfortunately poorly executed with Taven hitting the top rope. But man, an awful landing for Will Ospreay, which I guess at by this point, it's like it's kind of Will Ospreay doing Will Ospreay things. But I also thought it made Remsburg look really stupid, because this was the type of dive from Taven that required him to bounce off the ropes where Remsburg, his head was right there. So like, for him to have to ignore Taven bouncing off the ropes like inches away from him, I mean, the whole thing felt to me kind of poorly conceived.
There might have been interference in every single match on this show in some form or fashion. I mean, it was really just, to me, I mean, you're almost, it's white noise at this point. Like, you're not even thinking in the idea of, like, of course there's going to be all of this stuff that just comes with it. Ospreay takes them out with a Sky Twister press on the floor, and then after he comes down on the turnbuckle, Ospreay injures his knee, so Strong goes after it with a half crab and a clover leaf. And as he's going for the running boot, Ospreay stops him with a sit-out powerbomb. And there's this great sequence going to a Styles Clash attempt, but Strong kicks his way free, so Will hits the Os Cutter, but injures the knee further. And Bryce has to check on Ospreay, and Callis is furious here as Will is being like held off here. It was like, if he's down, isn't this a pinfall attempt, is it not? And Callis comes and calls for the Tiger Driver 91, tells him snap his neck, and he shoves Bryce aside, and you think Ospreay is going to go for the Tiger Driver. He lifts him, but just like Otis, he couldn't pull the trigger, and he can't do it. It's countered with an Olympic slam, running boot for a two count, and then goes for End of Heartache, but Will lands on his feet, hits the hidden blade, follows up with the Stormbreaker, and he pins Roderick Strong in 1740 to become the new international champion without needing the Tiger Driver 91.
No, he did not need it. Yeah. I thought this was a really good choice for an opener. You know, aside from being like a pretty guaranteed, like hot match, I love using openers as sort of like a showcase for your big next in line star. And I thought Ospreay kind of really benefited from this sort of spotlight in front of a fresh crowd. He felt really big, and he felt like really that sort of next in line top guy. There are some really impressive sequences in this one. I loved everything leading up to the Styles Clash tease and that Os Cutter. Some of the storyline points in this match, I don't know if I had to nitpick, it might have been some of those. For one thing, like, I kind of felt like the whole Tiger Driver 91 deal, like, it really, to me, was dampened by the fact that Bryan Danielson has simply come back without any real significant effect on his neck. So it, to me, completely kills Ospreay's concern for this move when it's really not that big of a deal, clearly, you know? So why would I feel like he should be feeling that sort of concern?
Do you think that driver in New York City has given up driving buses?
You mean the Darby one?
Yeah.
I mean, probably not. It's probably his life and career. So what do you mean?
Well, I mean, I'm just looking at a parallel here. Maybe he thought
bus driver and Tiger driver.
This could have been career ending. I'm going to retire bus driving at this point after
well, we don't know.
Wrestler.
Yeah.
But he might have the same thought, like, oh, he's come back. He's okay.
It could be that. Not to mention, like, I feel like I saw Ospreay take a way more significant neck injury spot in this particular match than even Roderick Strong did off of the Oscutter. But yeah, overall, really good high energy match that certainly does boost Ospreay's profile, I felt.
Yeah, I thought this match was a really strong opener and got the show off to a hot start. And just to hear the crowd, like, they were amped for this as soon as Will Ospreay came out. So very, very strong opener to start things out. And then you hear Adam Cole's music and he comes out by himself and is walking and says that Las Vegas sucks. He should be at home rehabbing his ankle, which begs the question why he's here, and then says that we all have a devil inside of us, and when he's 100%, you will give the devil his due. And this crowd is loudly chanting for MJF when the lights go out, and we've got this this musical, like this piano rendition of, or this orchestra doing MJF's theme, and it's from his perspective as he walks into a room full of MJF memorabilia, weapons, and then his suit.
Like artifacts and Easter eggs from his previous matches.
Yeah, kind of all like the MJF museum. And there's the scarf, and then the person from the perspective, we get a torn up photo of Adam Cole and MJF, and it fades to black, and then MJF's music plays. And it's subtle, but the camera's on Adam Cole, and when he hears that music, it's just like under his breath, oh shit, you can see him mouth the words. And out comes 2002 Paul Levesque, complete with this leather jacket jean combo, and MJF returns, and the dude was not packing light. Look at this guy.
I mean, you remember Triple H in 2002, right? You know,
I mean,
all we were short of was U2. But, you know, this certainly felt, I mean, knowing MJF, probably a very intentional reference to Hunter's famed comeback of that era.
I think more than a little subtle here, but yes.
Yeah, because who wears jean denim vests on top of leather jackets in 2024, you know, unless you're going for a Triple H reference.
Yeah, I thought this was a one of one in Madison Square Garden 24 years ago, but sure. MJF comes out and the place goes insane for him, and he comes to the ring and MJF hugs Adam Cole, and the crowd's furious at this, but then it's all the setup to kick him in the balls and hits Adam Cole with a brain buster and calls him a noodle-armed, bobble-headed son of a bitch and a shit stain. He said he gave Adam Cole trust, and that shit ain't happening again. He didn't take out MJF. All you did was wake him up, and I remembered who I was. I'm the greatest wrestler on God's green earth, and unlike those schmucks in the back, I don't need a New Japan or a Vince McMahon to make MJF. I made MJF. And there's going to be no more ha-ha, no more friendships, no more kangaroo kicks. It's going to wait for him to drop no more Kowloons for Chinese food. No more bullshit. He says that now he's fueled by hate. So the crowd starts chanting hate and no one's going to be safe. And he picks up the devil mask and states that masks are adorned by cowards who hide. I'm done hiding. I'm done apologizing for being great. All of your faves suck a big old bag of donkey dicks, which this classy crowd began chanting as well. And this mask,
so we're done with the kangaroo kicks and in with the donkey dicks.
We're elevating ourselves to donkey dicks. And he says that this mask makes my stomach turn, and it can go straight to hell, as he stomps the mask and morphed from Paul Levesque to Ric Flair, taking off the jacket, elbowing the mask and throwing it away. And before he ends the segment, he lets us in on the worst kept secret in professional wrestling. He has re-signed with AEW, but he has not just signed in on paper. He has signed in permanent ink, and he zooms in on his calf that reads, "Bet on yourself," with an AEW logo and poker chip. I'm wondering if the AEW portion of this was Magic Marker.
No, I don't think so.
He can switch at a later date.
The tattoo removal technology is incredible these days. So
yes, I thought he was going to reveal that he too has a history with Tony Storm and Deonna Purrazzo.
Well, we don't know who. Maybe they have. Have we seen their other ankle? We don't know.
We don't. This is a hell of a segment. One thing I really enjoyed about this was the fact that, number one, you have MJF coming back as like without question feels like the most red hot babyface for this next run. And on top of that, it felt like he was speaking with a huge segment of the audience by shitting on a lot of the stuff that people were most critical of that he was attached to last year, and kind of understanding like, I am with your criticisms that I was as well, and kind of denouncing that. And it just feels like you are listening to your audience instead of, you know, fighting your audience that and defending some of this stuff that devil mask, whatever you want to look at. Like, what that did lead to was a really strong pay-per-view number for that reveal, but you see that mask, and I don't think it brings back wonderful memories for people of the what that represented.
It's no secret that I think like the perception of AEW at the moment is that it's on a downturn that has kind of been simultaneous with WWE's upswing. And so much of, I think, what we remember of maybe when that was starting to become a noticeable like trait of AEW is with MJF up top with this devil storyline. It's probably unfair because a lot of those weeks we were looking at that double storyline is actually maybe some of the most intriguing stuff and some of the stuff that got the most over, you know, at least to the live audience. But nonetheless, those skits, you know, the comedic tone of them, it is somewhat at this point in hindsight representative of maybe a downswing in AEW sort of perception, at least. I found that to be the most interesting. I found most interesting about this how dismissive he was of Adam Cole. You know, when you're trying to like, this is like their big storyline that they at one point, like I think we had intended maybe they would try to do again at Wembley. This felt like it was MJF coming out here, kicking Adam Cole in the balls and telling him to get out of his ring with no further reference to Adam Cole whatsoever for the rest of his promo. Like, I almost wonder if this was just a quick, we spent enough time on that stuff. I'm done with it. Let's have me move on. And if it is, I would find that to be an incredibly bold move. I would certainly be concerned for Adam Cole and the Undisputed Kingdom coming out of it. But it would also be not a move I'd be completely against, because at this point with the current landscape of AEW, I'm kind of ready for MJF to move on. There are so many more attractive, you know, opponents for him. And how long are we going to wait for this Adam Cole thing? And is it going to be that interesting afterwards? I don't know. I did find it at least interesting how like dismissive he was of the whole Adam Cole thing coming out of this. But as a reintroductory promo, I thought this was fantastic. Like, this was the promise of a serious MJF, beautiful day MJF, if you will, you know, coming in, no more bullshit, and he's gunning for all the top guys in the company. So I thought it was a great sort of like proclamation that this is going to be a different MJF going forward.
I was curious to see if they were going to, because to me the big draw of Wednesday is MJF appearing on Dynamite and coming back on television. And if you recall, like, this should almost be the 180 promo that Double or Nothing 2 years ago, he loses that match to Wardlow, and then he goes on TV on that Wednesday, and that's the one where he just buries AEW, obliterates it, and now here is the guy that has inked AEW to his skin and is here to live and die by AEW, and is the guy that is going to lead AEW to the promised land. Maybe he will be dubbing himself 2 Bill Max or something like that. But I think if he's on Dynamite, I would have been plugging that tonight to, like, the Kia Forum is a big
what
venue.
What room would they have to have had on this show to plug anything on Dynamite?
Well, God forbid, yeah, if we took out any time from some of the dice spots that we'll get to here. But anyway, big angle on the show with MJF's return.
One of the most significant things on the show. Agreed, yeah.
This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, it's your chance to travel back to November 2004 as Wei Ting and I review WWE Raw featuring Trish Stratus and Lita headlining the show. Bruce Lord and Karen Peterson are going to be covering New Japan's Destruction in Kobe event, and MCU later tackles Agatha All Along. All of that, plus Rewind to SmackDown and Collision Course weekly, and ad-free versions of Rewind to Raw and Dynamite. $6 a month unlocks it all at postwrestlingcafe.com.
Bang Bang Gang and Death Triangle for the World Trios tag titles. We got triple drop kicks by Death Triangle onto Colton, and then stereo dives from the Lucha Brothers. And Pac takes his DDT. And my God, did he sell that? He was convulsing on the mat. The way he's like trying to push one of the guns off him as he's being covered, like he sold this neck, and they just beat on him for minutes on end before he made the tag. Penta's in with a Canadian Destroyer. All six men go down, and then they triple team White and hit the Fear Factor. When Phoenix dives to the floor on the guns, Pac climbs to the top for the Black Arrow, when the next biggest return of the night, Juice Robinson is back and knocks Pac off balance, setting up a Blade Runner and pinning Pac in 12 minutes and 21 seconds.
I actually felt like the match maybe, to me, left a little bit to be desired, considering like the really high bar the Death Triangle have set with their trios matches. And to me, maybe partly it's because I don't necessarily think the Bang Bang Gang are the caliber opponents that, for instance, the Elite were. I actually wasn't all that impressed by the Bang Bang Gang here, to be honest, nor did I think this feud was that hot to begin with. But I was really happy to see Juice Robinson back. You know, the return was enough to make the finish feel satisfying and to give it some substance. He's certainly been missed in the group, and what an afro the man returns with. Look at this beautiful mane.
Oh, I mean, we haven't seen him since November, so he's had a long time to grow it out, and this will add something for this group. And yeah, I wouldn't say this was one of the big hallmark matches of the show. This would be one of several matches that I think could have been more effectively utilized for, like, what we see with a WWE, where you build up all these programs and you pay off some of them on television, especially with a return like this. By the end of the show, I don't think anyone was thinking about Juice Robinson. Mm-hmm. Timeless Toni Storm against Serena Deeb for the AEW Women's Championship. And Serena comes out with a shirt that reads Deeb or Nothing. It's double or nothing, but it's
really
Deeb or Nothing.
Yep. Yeah.
And she's reclaimed her Deeb's Dojo flag, and she hands off her flag to a fan in the front row, this despicable heel. And Storm comes out and gets a big reaction. Early on, she's placed in the Paradise Lock, and then it's broken out of that. Storm uses a backstabber, and then when Deeb stops a sky high, she applies the armbar, but is slammed off, and it's Storm going after her with a clover leaf. Deeb comes out and hits a spinning neck breaker as the crowd is chanting for Tony, and Deeb just looks astounded at these fans. How dare you cheer for Toni Storm? I thought we had cleared this all up over the past couple of nights, but Deeb applies the single leg crab, going after Storm's injured knee, drives the knee into the mat. She's wrenching on it, and Mariah May wants to throw in the towel, but Luther prevents Mariah May from throwing the towel in. So then Storm sees the towel and thinks Luther's going to throw it in, so she takes the towel and just throws it into the crowd. Deeb uses, she just puts up her middle fingers to prevent Storm from delivering the hip attack and is just luring her in for a jackknife cover, but it's countered into Storm Zero. Deeb kicks out of that, and we get more dragon screws by Deeb, and the Deeb talks on the edge of the apron. Another inside of the ring. Toni kicks out. Everyone is cheering for her. And then it's Storm who bounces Deeb's head off the top turnbuckle as Deeb climbs. And the announcers criticize. Deeb never climbs to the top, but she tried here. Gets caught. Storm Zero off the second turnbuckle and a follow-up. 15 minutes and 39 seconds as Toni Storm retains the title and then lays on the ramp with Mariah May with the confetti coming down.
I really enjoyed this match. I thought it was actually pretty great. What's interesting is how they really just kind of pivoted the heel babyface dynamic in this feud without any real storyline reason. And it's so interesting because you kind of have a very similar, well, not to say like Willow versus Mercedes was ever, you know, required Willow to turn heel or anything, but it did require some shift in that storyline with Mercedes. And we have something similar here where you almost had a bit of a double turn in the body of this buildup. But they didn't have to give us any real storyline reason for why the crowd is suddenly booing Serena Deeb. The crowd just simply chose, you know, Toni Storm over Deeb. And Deeb, I thought, in this match was almost kind of occupying a space where she was actively acting confused about why the crowd was turning on her. And that gives her great storyline material to follow this feud with if they choose to give Deeb that airtime. She has, you can tell just even within some of the looks she gave this audience, she has a promo within her to ask, what did I do to you? All I did was spill my heart to you guys about my comeback, and you guys.
But then she jumped Toni Storm on Wednesday. That was the whole go home angle.
Because Toni has been a real jerk to her. That's nothing about, you know, whether or not the crowd should want to cheer her for jumping Toni Storm. Anyway, there's a lot for Deeb here to come off of if they choose to give her. I thought Deeb was really great here. Her submission style was used very effectively to make her feel like a threatening, dominant heel, and it allowed Toni Storm to work a very sympathetic babyface matchup.
Trent Barretta and Orange Cassidy, straight up.
By the way, so they did a lot of stuff with Mariah May here, seemingly almost like teasing early on a bit of a breakup where, like, I guess she is sort of introducing certain elements and making Luther take the blame for it. So we are headed towards Forbidden Door, and you would expect Mina Shirakawa, with her sort of a continued involvement up to this point, to certainly be involved with either Mariah May, if not Toni Storm. So I'm kind of curious to see how that all plays out. Like, it might be time for May to turn on Toni, with Toni being pretty much a full-on babyface at this point.
I could see maybe they're a team at Forbidden Door, and that could start to
who
break Storm and May? Toni Storm and Mariah May have to team together and
against Shirakawa and somebody.
Could be an idea of something or that, or you could do even like Mina Shirakawa has to team with the two of them, and it's like she's got the alliance with Mariah May, and Toni Storm's kind of the odd one out, and you've got this weird fracture.
You could do Shirakawa versus Storm, and a May caught in the middle. Yeah.
Trent Barretta and Orange Cassidy. Don Callis is back on commentary. Trent has Chuck written on his wrist tape, and they start playing Jane, and then it stops, and Orange Cassidy comes out to the Pixies. And this is a darker version of Orange Cassidy, because we learn he is wearing a black t-shirt and darker denim.
Yeah, I find it amusing that we're at the point now where, like, hearing Orange Cassidy's Pixies theme is considered nostalgic. Like, what are we, like, 2 years removed from it?
Yeah,
at this point.
About that.
And yeah, black t-shirt, Orange Cassidy, yes.
I like that he announced it.
No aviators, he's wearing wafers.
Yeah. They also mentioned the black sunglasses here. So this is the man trying to communicate his darkness from within.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So match. It was a well wrestled match. They had, as you would expect, between these two. Trent goes for the eyes and then strikes him in the throat, and he's really milking the boos from the crowd, and they're getting on him with asshole chants. And Cassidy puts his hands in the pockets, and Trent just attacks with forearms and chops in the corner. They fight on the edge, and it lands with a Gotch style pile driver from Trent, who then grabs the steps, and Cassidy yanks his leg out, so Trent just crashes down on the steps, is hit with a beach break, and then Trent blocks the stun gun, hits a strong zero for a two count, and the Orange punch is blocked as Trent goes for his go-go plata, but Orange has it scouted because he just rolls over into a bridging jackknife cover, catching Trent at 14:03. Don Callis puts over Orange Cassidy as an icon, and Trent is in complete disbelief that he has lost this match. And as he is walking to the back, Rocky Romero comes out to check on Trent, and Renee, just needing to get an interview with the loser, doesn't want to talk to the winner, has to talk with the loser, and says, "What does this mean for you going forward?" Trent's like, "I'm not doing this. I'm done." And he just walks through the crowd. And maybe this is the end of Trent that we have seen. Just never hear from the man again.
I guess so. Where do you go after you've already turned heel? You've just kind of, like, you know, abandoned all your friends. Like,
and you've lost a straight wrestling match.
You've lost. So he lost to Orange Cassidy like 2 weeks ago. he's actually 0-3 against Orange Cassidy, you know, career. So can you, like, where's he going to go after this? Can you turn more heel than you already have? Or do you just go back to being a babyface at this point? I don't know. Don't know for Trent. Good match. You know, despite like the what is it, like black t-shirt and like sunglasses and everything. I mean, this was a pretty typical Orange Cassidy match, you know, like really good action. But like he's the clear babyface, good crowd engagement, hands in pockets, all this stuff. So nothing significantly different about his in-ring style whatsoever, or any sort of like heel teases or anything involving Callis. And maybe it's for that reason that like I'm not really buying it into any of this Callis stuff, because it's
well, we're getting the angle this week, because later they interviewed Don Callis and he stated he's going to be presenting a contract for the Don Callis family, in reference to Orange Cassidy. So it looks like
he didn't specifically say Cassidy. So.
He didn't specifically say Cassie. He was asked about Cassidy and said he'd be presenting a contract this Wednesday. So it could be some swerve for something else. And maybe that's where Trent fits in. But it makes no storyline sense why Callis would be recruiting this guy.
But I just don't see like Cassidy reciprocating any of these teases at all. It's not like he's in the body of this match is like teasing going bad. Like he's not really doing anything different.
Did you miss the black shades?
I did not. No, nor the black t-shirt. Yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe when he starts wearing leather with denim on top, that's when I'll know he'll really have changed.
The FTW Championship was defended by Chris Jericho against Hook and Katsuyori Shibata in quite the match. And this was your hardcore match to utilize all of the weapons. You see, I imagine during the day they sat down. They're like, okay, what does Anarchy in the Arena have slotted for their weapon use? And, Adam Copeland's in a barbed wire cage match, so that eliminates that. What would be left for us? And they told them, well, we can do tables in more than one match, but you're going to get dice. That's what we have left. Everything else is accounted for. And they're like, okay, we will build a match around dice. So Jericho.
I mean, it was entirely, this is kind of like something that we saw it in Winnipeg, right? With the hockey pucks. It's sort of a running gimmick now, I would assume, with these Jericho FTW championship matches, where what's in the black pouch, probably something to do with the local, whatever the city's known for.
Okay. So he pours out his bag of dice all over the mat, and we just see Jericho suplexed all over these dice, and they double team Jericho. Hook hits a Northern Lights to Shibata onto the dice. Then Shibata delivers a belly to belly to Hook on them. Of course, we get kendo sticks in here. Shibata then, at one point, he gets the dice and starts whipping them at Jericho. And then we get the spot where the table is set up in the ring. Jericho is placed on this table and Hook is on the turnbuckle. So Shibata is fighting Hook and he is taking a long time to get Hook into position onto his shoulders, where he is going to deliver a Death Valley driver off the turnbuckle, putting Hook through Jericho on the table. I guess what could go wrong, right? For a guy like Katsuyori Shibata, what an idea here. So he basically doesn't miss Jericho, but Hook like slides off of Jericho's body, and then Jericho like tumbles onto Hook. This table tumbles over as well. Shibata comes down and he's going down like head first onto the mat. I rewound this like three times and watched this, and the man miraculously was okay. And just a frightening looking spot when we're talking about Katsuyori Shibata coming down head first off of a turnbuckle with three other bodies and a table.
I was more concerned for Hook and the way he landed on Jericho's body with like his, like, I mean, it didn't look good for anybody. Hopefully nobody's too hurt.
I mean, they all continued here. Jericho gets sent through a table in the corner, and then the Judas effect is caught by the Red Rum when Big Bill runs in to break it up. So that leads to Hook taking Big Bill and sending him off the apron with a T-bone through this table that goes, he lands right next to the leg of the chair. And the announcers are like, well, that nearly pierced the man's entire body and killed Big Bill, but he was alive. So the walls are applied to Shibata. It's countered into a figure four, and Hook applies the red rum simultaneously when a mystery man runs in with a trash can, hitting them all, and it's revealed to be Brian Keith. This crowd had no idea who this was, but this was...
He got a reaction. He got a pretty okay reaction, I felt.
I don't know about that, but he was revealed to be, I guess, the latest member of the Learning Tree. And we get a Judas effect to Hook. And Shibata is, meanwhile, inside of a trash can, attacked by Keith. And Jericho pins Shibata inside of the trash can at 12 minutes and 40 seconds.
It was a very chaotic match. You know, it did to me feel like an attempt to continue the tone set by the hockey puck match in Winnipeg. And it's essentially Jericho's take on the hardcore match. And I really do love the black bag gimmick, tailoring items to the location that they're in. At this point, hockey pucks and dice are far more memorable than thumbtacks. So it's just, it's an interesting, you know, in place of where we've gotten to. Thumbtacks on Reebok pumps, though, that's a totally different story, as we will discuss later on. Things definitely weren't the smoothest here, you know, namely that DVD through the table. They recovered fine, but I hope everybody involved is okay off of it. Hook at one point looked really lost partway through, having to like communicate very clearly to both men. And this was also where I felt like the run-ins were almost a little too abundant, even by this point in the show, where you had both Big Bill and Brian Keith. And AEW, I almost get like in my mind feel like at one point was kind of known for being the place where you didn't get that sort of stuff, and now it feels like you're getting these sort of heel run-ins as often as you do in the WWE, if not even more sometimes.
This was overload on this show. I didn't really enjoy this match. I'm like, hardcore matches are one thing. I feel like the tone here is supposed to be like comedy hardcore matches, which I don't enjoy it at all.
It's a bit of both.
You can do both. They can be done. I would say the Winnipeg match with Shibata, I think that did work. That was an example of something that did work, where they did incorporate some comedy and it worked for that crowd. This one, I did feel Hook was kind of lost at parts in this as well. The Jericho character is a weird one. Like, I certainly enjoy some of the sentiments of it. I also view this, I look at this guy and just... like, this is Jericho somebody that you are spending all of this money on? Is this, are you getting that return for Jericho in this kind of low end comedy heel role?
What is the alternative? Putting him in like what, the world title picture?
The alternative might be that he could be a guy that's more of an attraction at this point rather than like this.
But then how do you justify paying him what you're paying him? If you're,
are you justifying it with this role?
They're justifying it by putting him on TV and having him pop quarters. And he does, like, he still does pretty well, you know, on television. Right. I think they're committed to having Jericho on this roster. They see value in having Jericho on this roster, and they want him to be a constant presence on this roster. And this is, I think, the best idea that they have and he has for his place in the company right now.
What do you think about the addition of Brian Keith and making this now a three-man group going forward?
I'm happy for Brian Keith to actually get what feels like hopefully a substantial role. But unfortunately, that role is a part of the Jericho Vortex. So now this is going to be a test. You know, Big Bill is a test to see how he comes out of this. Brian Keith is another test to see if he can actually come out of this. But for Keith, it's almost anything is like a net positive, because he didn't really have a role prior to this. So hopefully this gives him at least some airtime. It gives him some identity. It makes sense that the Jericho, the Learning Tree would hire a bounty hunter. So we'll see what they do with him. I'm more curious also about like Hook and Shibata's role coming out of this. Now, it's been pretty long, I feel like, since they've been attached. And do Hook and Shibata continue to be involved in all of this? Or do they now exit the Jericho Vortex kind of feeling like used goods?
Yeah, I don't know what the next step is for Hook. He's been this long-term project, and you know, is he progressing at a stage when you are so loaded with, and you only have so many spots, like where a Hook fits, and is he ready for the next step? Either.
Yeah, I don't know.
This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, it's your chance to travel back to November 2004 as Wei Ting and I review WWE Raw, featuring Trish Stratus and Lita headlining the show. Bruce Lord and Karen Peterson are going to be covering New Japan's Destruction in Kobe event, and MCU Later tackles Agatha All Along. All of that, plus Rewind to SmackDown and Collision Course weekly, and ad-free versions of Rewind to Raw and Dynamite. $6 a month unlocks it all at postwrestlingcafe.com.
John Moxley against Konosuke Takeshita in an eliminator for the IWGP World Heavyweight title shot. Moxley comes out in the same jacket he wore for his debut 5 years ago, and his left arm heavily taped after the angle on Collision, where it was snapped through the chair. So early on, it's Takeshita just grinding on the shoulder. Moxley's doing a lot of heavy selling, and Callis is telling Takeshita, "I think the arm is broken." But Moxley comes to life, the bandage is coming off, and he starts absorbing strikes when he catches Takeshita with a cutter. And Takeshita follows with a Fujiwara armbar, hits a bastard driver into a wheelbarrow suplex, and the fans are cheering here as he goes for the power drive knee, but he is caught with a paradigm shift. Moxley is too injured to capitalize on the cover. And then Takeshita drops him with another forearm and hits the power drive knee. Moxley kicks out, and the Death Rider gets stopped as Takeshita runs the shoulder into the post, and Takeshita hits his own Death Rider for a near fall, when Takeshita then slides a chair into the ring, and as Takeshita is entering, gets curb stomped onto his own chair, and Moxley proceeds with the Death Rider and pins him in 17 minutes and 23 seconds. No title match for Konosuke Takeshita against Moxley or Evil.
Mm-hmm. No. So I guess in hindsight, could they have just made this an IWGP title match, in your opinion? Or do you think the fact that it was an eliminator helped suspend your disbelief a bit more?
I thought that the combination of eliminator match and doing this arm injury the night before, it just felt like it was too much to try and tip the balance here when Moxley was just winning. I just felt it was a lot. Like you basically had the one-armed man without his title on the line here come out on top. I just don't know what you really got out of this injury angle.
I guess the idea was that it was Callis that cost Takeshita the match, and that Takeshita was, you know, very much on his way, if not for Callis's poor instruction. So, I mean, they are telling a story off of it. I thought the match was an enjoyable match, like really great looking offense from Takeshita as usual. Those forearms sound and look incredible. Everything he does looks and sounds incredible. It was a different style of Moxley match, though. You know, like it was Moxley selling a body part, and it's admittedly not my favorite type of John Moxley match, because I love him being the aggressor, whether as a babyface or as a heel. So maybe in my mind, I had envisioned this being more of like a firefight between these two, just kind of unloading, you know, everything like G1 style. And maybe I came out of it just a little bit disappointed, because I had pictured in my head like this like show stealing bout, which I didn't necessarily think this was. But it was still a very good, well worked match.
Got a lot of time as well on the show. I mean, maybe I'm sure that they should have this arm injury, I think, linger for a little. Like, he should go into that Evil match, and perhaps that's who Don Callis is working with. Evil.
Evil joins the Don Callis family. So would that pair?
Maybe that's who the contract is going to be this week. Evil accepts the contract to go bring this title to Don Callis.
That would just kind of like make my brain melt, because I feel like Jeff Cobb is still part of the United Kingdom, which is still somewhat like kind of associated with the Don Callis family. And you have Jack Perry, who's still in the House of Torture, who's not a part of the Don Callis family. So how does that whole web work?
Well, they always have loose affiliations, no matter where they go in the world. Hmm. So there was a Forbidden Door promo for June 30th and the Casino Gauntlet that is taking place Wednesday at the Kia Forum. Barbed wire steel cage match, Adam Copeland against Malakai Black for the TNT Championship. There was a really good video package for this involving Adam Copeland with photos with his children, and they utilized his big pep rally speech to the crowd as that being like Malakai Black trying to, like, this guy has just become like toxic positivity, Adam Copeland, and we've got to drag him back to the bowels of evil. Copeland, I should say, I thought he did an awesome promo on Saturday's Collision, like a really good go home promo, and the end line when you when you look evil in the eyes, it's already too late. So we got quite the entrance here. First, Malachi Black comes out, and then Adam Copeland comes out with the Brood style entrance. It's like, oh, this is a nice nod. And then on the screen, just flat out, the Brood. So this dude, he's got his theme song. He's got the Rated R Superstar. He's got the Brood. I'm just waiting for him to show up one week on Dynamite as Edge. I mean, he just, the man has like just secured a lot of his history without anyone being any the wiser. And by the way, came out to Slayer here as well. So yeah. Take that, Damian Priest, the real owner of South of Heaven here.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, he couldn't get the theme song, but I guess Slayer is a really good backup choice. I guess the Brood is not a trademarked WWE thing.
Obviously not. Yeah, they got it.
Yeah, okay. Well, good for him. I like the fact that he spelled it out for us. You weren't sure what the reference is? It's the Brood, everybody. Look on the screen.
We get a cartoon reenactment of their greatest WWE moments to get around the footage. Uh-huh. So they start off with a joust with chairs, and the barbed wire is surrounding the cage, and Black is the first one to get his forehead stuck into the barbed wire, so he bled a ton here. Copeland would follow suit shortly thereafter, and we get Black going for the end, which is stopped with a spear, and he wraps Black with barbed wire around this table. And Copeland climbs to the top of the cage, and Tony Schiavone with the understatement of the night, this is so dangerous. And then Copeland jumps off the top of this cage, and I'm just waiting for him to like angle his body. This guy comes down like he's just trying to get to the bottom of the ocean with this jump. He comes down like feet first. Dude, I gasped. I thought he like blew out his knees coming down here.
He could have,
don't know what his state was. He continued for another 10 minutes after this. This was one of, on a night where we saw like fire and thumbtacks on shoes, this was probably the scariest thing I watched on this show. This 50-year-old man coming down at this height, at this speed, and could have just blown out a hip or knees or God knows what.
Yeah. Do you remember like Edge diving off the cage like this before? From the top of the cage.
I don't remember him doing an elbow drop off of something this size. I mean, we saw him do like the big spears and stuff like in the ladder matches off of great heights and stuff, but not, I don't recall this guy doing an elbow drop from this height, because it looked like I was watching him do the first elbow drop of his life off the top here.
It kind of did. Yeah. So I have all the respect in the world for this man choosing to do this at age 50. He's 50 this year and is diving off of cages. I pray his knees are in okay shape, because this did not look fun, no matter what age you were.
Black kicks out of this. I don't know if Adam Copeland was ready to kick out of this. And Copeland goes for a spear, but is hit with the end and he kicks out. So Black brings out a spool of barbed wire, misses Copeland where he's trying to stab him, and he kicks Copeland through the door, but is met with a spear on the floor. This is when Buddy Matthews and Brody King walk out. They're standing with Malachi, but then they turn their back on Malachi and align with Adam Copeland, and the whole crowd is like buzzing at this betrayal of Buddy Matthews and Brody King, but it is all a ploy by Malachi as they attack Copeland and beat him down, and they wrap Adam Copeland in barbed wire, and they give him like a crown of barbed wire around his forehead, when suddenly the lights start flickering red and you hear this music, and emerging through the bottom of the ring, it's Gangrel. And he starts to attack Brody King and Buddy Matthews. He's hitting Impaler DDTs, and then he eats the end. And the spear is hit by Copeland in the barbed wire as he applies the crossface to Black with the barbed wire, forcing Malachi to go out cold at 20 minutes and 19 seconds. And we get Adam Copeland and Gangrel leaving together up the stage, as Adam Copeland had wanted to do several years ago and was turned down.
He got his Gangrel moment.
Gangrel got his Double or Nothing moment.
Oh,
still fanging and banging all these years later.
Still got the puffy shirt. Yeah. What a crazy match this was.
This was nuts. But I thought for what it was, like I thought these guys worked a tremendous match.
They worked their asses off for this one. You know, again, so much respect for Adam Copeland coming into AEW at the age of 50, already on his second career, already a WWE Hall of Famer. You've already collected all the accolades. And you're coming in and you're choosing to have matches like these. You know, forget like the barbed wire. It's like, it's that dive off the top of the cage that I think will, there was a very noticeable limp from this man afterwards. And I hope most of it was selling because I'm sure he's feeling at least some of it. I'm very concerned for his leg. I hope it does not put a premature end to his TNT title run. Because I think he's just really doing some fantastic work. Gangrel looked awesome, I thought. Didn't you, John?
He was a great addition, great idea. Like, as I think we even said it on one of the shows this week, like, if ever you were going to do this, this was the match that they had built up. Like, Adam Copeland embracing this dark side. I love that this brood aspect of Adam Copeland's career is so prominent when, realistically, it was like a year of his career. Like, he was comedy with Christian by late 99, early 2000. You know what I mean? It was like, sure, we're talking 24, 25 years ago, but everyone associates this with Edge, and it got the desired reaction. And I thought that this was, it was a really well laid out match. And we talk about so many times these cage matches that sometimes with the audience expectation, it restricts what you can do. That was not the case in this one. They had a lot of creative stuff in this match.
This was a match where I wish they were more restricted. And I wish they had somebody tell them, don't do that. Because, yeah, they did a lot here. It was a really, really entertaining match and very well done. And the fact that he got the brood, presumably either copyrighted or protected from WWE's copyright, tells me that we're going to get a full crew back, I think. Don't you? Do you think it's time for Christian to, you know, give up the gimmick and go back to his roots?
This version of Christian, I don't want to see Christian near these guys. I mean, he's got a great thing going. What I wanted was when Christian was like warming up, I wanted to see these guys just like walk back and almost like just share a look and just nod and go their separate ways, like two ships crossing in the night. I think that would have been the spot to do on this show. Lexi Nair interviews Callis, and he's going to offer the contract on Wednesday. And that takes us to Willow Nightingale and Mercedes Moné, that they're billing the first of three main events. And boy, did they set this up as a main event on the show with Mercedes' entrance. First of all, we get this video where it is showcasing all of these iconic females, from Amelia Earhart, Rosa Parks, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Serena Williams, and the inspirational message from Mercedes Moné to believe in yourself, be the change you want to see. And then we get
we got to talk about this video. Okay. This to me was like an interesting point and a point of discussion in all of this. So we could tell, at least by maybe some of the TV and certainly by the start of this match, that Mercedes Moné is a heel. Would you not agree? Is that pretty
going
clear?
Into this? I think it had been pretty clear. And when this match began, that's how the audience,
she was playing a cowardly heel running away from Willow. So I felt like that was evident, but this was like purely, I think on the surface, babyface type of video, like, you know, okay. It is a babyface video with a babyface message, believe in yourself, bet on yourself, you know, MJF, I'm sure, you know, watch this and then got that tattoo. But if you also look at it from a heelish perspective, it kind of also works. Because what kind of person would compare themselves as a professional wrestler to Rosa Parks and Ruth Bader Ginsburg? Like, who is pompous enough to think that they are of the same caliber as these type of people? And I mean, if you ask her, maybe that's not the intent of the video, but that's certainly how you can interpret it. So I'm curious to know if this was actually her intent to give you like
I took it more the way you did, about just like her putting herself at this level of Rosa Parks here. But then you got like this. It was like Daft Punk, the marching band version coming out, followed by like these Vegas showgirls. I mean, this is just the most over-the-top entrance for Mercedes Moné, but totally worked for what they were trying to present her as. Like, just this, like, she was doing like her mini WrestleMania entrance in AEW, and I kind of like that. Like, they're not hitting you over the head with it, but that was sort of like the desired, like, here's
it works.
It works for what they were trying to. And then you have... the juxtaposition here, Willow comes out and Stokely and Chris Statlander have this enlarged friendship bracelet. That's the extent of her budget for the entrance. I don't even know where you construct such a thing.
Cost a lot of money to make.
It did. And for one night's use, this crowd was going nuts. They felt like this was a major match and they held up for the whole thing. Like, they treated this like this felt like one of the big main events on the show, and the crowd, they were a big part of this. And the dynamic, for whatever you want to say about the buildup, like, they were all behind Willow, and it got to be Mercedes.
Kind of 50-50 at points. Yeah.
But you could see, like, the crowd favorite was Willow here. And Moné was really playing up like her aspect of things. But early on, Moné is hit with a doctor bomb onto the apron, and you saw Willow almost with like a version of Kreutz Wrath in the ring. Moné then knocks her off balance on the turnbuckle, and she goes after Willow's ankle, which was a great story in this match. Was, you took a year out of my life, I'm going to try and do the same to you and take out your ankle. So Willow would go after Monet's previously injured ankle as well, and everyone understood what the two were doing here, and it was a great story. Willow and Moné are exchanging ankle locks, and then hits a babe with the power bomb, but Moné stops it, and they go onto the turnbuckle. Moné tries for the sunset bomb and follows with a figure four ankle lock submission. Willow lifts her up and has her by the ankle on the edge. There's a meteora to the floor by Moné. And then Stokely is on the apron arguing with the referee when Willow hits the babe with the power bomb, and Aubrey is delayed in making the count because of Stokely. And the crowd is like, they are infuriated that Willow is winning this match and Stokely is distracting her. I just, like, they were so intense for this.
Statlander was involved as well.
Yeah, she was like trying to get Stokely's attention, but together they were both distracting Aubrey. So she goes for another one, and it's turned into the bank statement, moves to an STF, and Willow fights her way to the rope. And then Moné is seated on the top, knocks Willow down, flips over her back, and lifts her up for the moneymaker and pins her in 18 minutes of what I thought was a really strong match between these two. For whatever you want to say about any of the matches on the show, this was the one that was going to have the most critical eye attached to it for Mercedes. It's a huge signing for this company. It's not as though it's been this blow away arrival in the company. But as I said, if this match delivered in a big way, I think all of that would be forgotten or forgiven. And she came out here, I thought both of them were tremendous in this match, and more importantly, the crowd treated this like, it's not like this was a crowd that was just, you know, giving their applause and being respectful. They were super into this match. It felt really big.
It did, yeah, from the moment it began. So I mean, I think we can say, or at least I can say, I think the creative for these several months has been somewhat disappointing, more importantly, I think her promos and her presence has kind of been disappointing, without having wrestling to kind of rely on. But that didn't really matter at all to the crowd tonight, because they were getting to see what Mercedes Moné was signed for. You got to see her wrestle, and they treated this like it was an incredibly big deal from the get-go. I really enjoyed the match, you know, namely because this was an incredibly hot crowd for the entire thing. And I think these two did a great job. You know, it was definitely clear that Moné was playing heel from the start, but I thought there were equal moments throughout the match where both kind of had their babyface shine. And it's to the point where, like, I almost get the sense she might be reverting back to being a babyface after this match, after the Willow program. But we'll see. It gave you
her value should be able to adjust. And I think when people talk about these shades of gray characters, I think some people look at it as though it's like, well, that's an ill-defined character. But I think the beauty in having these characters that they don't have to make these hard 180 shifts and go from dastardly heel to lovable babyface. It's the ones that can kind of play in these margins and adjust for the situation. And it's not a shock to the fan system when they're watching how they can go. And you have more people at your disposal to work with.
Like a John Moxley, I think is a perfect example.
Perfect.
Now, not a great example is somebody like a Toni Storm, who can also do that, but because she works so much better as a babyface against her opponents, like, that should be the decision that you make from the get-go. Similar to how in this feud, Monet worked as a clearly better heel compared to somebody like a Willow, who the audience simply seems to like better. And Monet, as this CEO character, that much more natural as a heel. But the body of the match is kind of what we are going to be talking about, and more like is sort of the bread and butter of like Mercedes Moné. And she worked a really good match, focusing on the ankle injury, both her selling of it and also working on Willow through it. Maybe some blemishes in this, like in that I get the sense she was a little bit slower and not as smooth, but
there was one spot, and it doesn't come to mind the specific one, but like one of the great crutches they had was like the ankle injuries. It's like, and then being off balance, that Excalibur was really good with. And even like, like the setup to the moneymaker at the end, I don't think that should have looked seamless or crisp. I mean, this is this larger woman that you're getting up for this moneymaker to hit.
But it shouldn't have won the match. And that, like, first of all, it didn't bother me that this was not the crispest, smoothest match, because number one, she's coming off of a year layoff from a career ending injury. So the fact she was able to come out to the stage and have a match of this quality, I think is huge testament to her comeback. But the finish, I do have something to complain about, because this is not the first time we've seen the moneymaker not look good. And when it's supposed to be the end of a match and supposed to be the thing that's supposed to finish Willow, she needs to tweak that thing or get the entire roster to rehearse it a million times so that you don't have.
It's going to be a hard finish for everyone to get. Like, for if you're talking about like someone like a Willow, like that's a tough move to pull off.
And I don't even know if it's on Willow or if it's just like, it's just number one, I think it's too convoluted of a movement to be believable. Secondly, like the timing to nail it at this point, just like we've seen, it doesn't have a great success rate considering it's supposed to be the finishing move here. So I don't like it, but she'll probably continue to work at it until, you know, maybe everybody gets used to it. But I thought overall the match really lived up to its billing, and it was one of the hotter, more compelling matches on this entire show. And that's a huge achievement considering the amount of talent that they were up against.
Yeah. I mean, this to me is going to be like, I think this and the main event are going to be the memorable matches coming out of this show, and MJF's return. To me, those are the top three things on this show. So I thought these two did a really great job in this. And then afterwards, Stokely is furious, yelling at Willow, and Statlander shoves down Stokely and leaves with Willow. They get to the ramp and Statlander attacks Willow and drops her as Stokely is laughing, and she tears off her friendship bracelet and drops it. And if there was a complaint I had consistently, and I didn't mind this on the undercard, was, I mean, they were going super fast. It was like, if there was a post-match thing, it was like 30 seconds, boom, we're going to the video package. Boom, 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 boom. But when you're doing something so impactful like this, it does feel as though we got to move. We can't even digest this. This is a big turn. This should not just be, boom, we got to go to a video package and move on from it. This was one, it needed some more gravity to really let it digest. And I think that was just, like, it showed you there was so much on this show, and they were just trying to move as quickly as they can. But there was a ton that they were fitting into this and still going long.
I totally agree. I mean, a moment like this has been built up to at this point, like, what, for years? And to kind of cut away from it as quickly as they did was somewhat unfortunate. It's a turn that's been a long time coming. I'm curious to see what Statlander can do as a heel. And are we to assume that she was the one who attacked Monet?
They've coming still got to answer that. Yeah, that was like the lingering whodunit.
So that would tell you Monet would want to get revenge on her, and that she would be staying as a babyface, if that's the case.
Could be possible.
This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, it's your chance to travel back to November 2004 as Wei Ting and I review WWE Raw featuring Trish Stratus and Lita headlining the show. Bruce Lord and Karen Peterson are going to be covering New Japan's Destruction in Kobe event, and MCU Later tackles Agatha All Along. All of that, plus Rewind to SmackDown and Collision Course weekly, and ad-free versions of Rewind to Raw and Dynamite. $6 a month unlocks it all at postwrestlingcafe.com.
Swerve Strickland and Christian Cage, maybe the toughest spot on this show, following like what was a really two super heated matches, I would say, with Copeland and Malakai Black that had a ton of violence. Then you had a really heated women's match, and you know there's a very big, crazy, violent match to come. And I think a lot of people, as soon as this, really, it was when the TBS title match started at 11 that people realized this is not ending at midnight. We're going way past it. And you got 25 minutes out of Swerve and Christian Cage. Swerve came out in gear from the Warriors film.
Mm-hmm.
And Cage coming out in his requisite turtleneck. So early on, it's a pretty slow start. Cage starts posing, and Taz compares him to Dave Draper in 1972, which I thought was very funny line. Swerve counters a spear with a power slam and starts getting in offense, yanks the turtleneck over top of Christian's head and starts wailing away and hitting him with neck breakers, a Fosbury flop, and then Mother Wayne has the belt. Prince Nana yanks the belt away, and it's Prince Nana that gets ejected, and this crowd was furious at Paul Turner. Killswitch and Nick Wayne then attack Swerve on the floor as Mother Wayne is distracting, and then eventually Paul Turner catches all of them and ejects the patriarchy. So Cage is left with Swerve alone here for the ending, and gouges the eyes, tries for a sunset bomb onto the steps on the floor, but is hit by a stomp, and Swerve dives at Cage, and Cage sidesteps, so Swerve dives onto the steps and basically goes face first onto the bottom step on the floor. So then Nick Wayne returns after being ejected with this cutter out of nowhere and rolls Swerve in. He's hiding. Killswitch is as well coming down here. This is where, like, the run-ins at this point, I'm just thinking, like, have we had a match on this show without any run-ins? And the closest we had was the last one where you had the Stokely-Statlander distraction spot. But they were plenty on this show and plenty in this one. So then Nana comes back with a pipe to chase Nick out through the crowd. So then Swerve and Cage are fighting on the desk, and the kill switch is countered with a Swerve stomp on top of the desk, which apparently now these AEW desks are Sanjay Dutt proof, because this Swerve stomp didn't move this desk a centimeter.
Mm-mm.
They are not taking their chances anymore.
Welded them, rigid. Yeah.
Cage gets back into the ring, and his final flurry is a running spear where he leaps into a midair house call, hits the Swerve stomp, and then one more house call from Swerve to retain the title at 24 minutes and 50 seconds. And there in the front row was a WrestleMania main eventer, Floyd Mayweather Jr. himself, posing here with Swerve Strickland as well. So I thought this was a really great match, and I give them extra credit because I thought this was a really tough spot on the show. When you knew you were getting a super long main event, this crowd has been in this arena now for many hours, but they did get into this one.
They did. Yeah. Like, the fact that they got this sort of like consistent reaction from the crowd without the use of blood, without the use of weapons, without any like real kind of like special gimmick attached to the match, and being almost 5 hours deep into the show at this point, I think is incredibly impressive and tells you a lot about how much this crowd cares about Swerve as their champion. That's a huge accolade, I think, for both he and Christian. But I have to say, like, when you're trying to build a triple main event, this did not really feel of that caliber to me. And I think so much of it is because I just don't see Christian as that sort of contender. You know, this was a bit of a lame duck program for me to begin with, because, I mean, they had to excuse Christian bypassing the rankings through the Elite in order to, like, you know, be put into this position. And while I love Christian as sort of like a TNT champion level, like, top act, he's not a world title competing act to me. And I think that affected, like, at least how I perceived this match this deep into the show. Like, it didn't have the grandeur that I expect of a pay-per-view title match involving the world champion. And the Monet match like actually had that feeling, you know, whereas this unfortunately didn't.
It was of the two, the TBS match was the more heated for sure. Okada, the Young Bucks, and Jack Perry against Brian Danielson, FTR, and Darby Allin. Anarchy in the arena with Justin Roberts announcing, "Welcome to the shit show. This is Anarchy in the Arena." And we get the entrances, and maybe this was them just, we got to get to this match because Danielson and FTR just jumped them during the entrance. They come out through the crowd and they're attacking them. And then Darby's music plays, and out he comes wearing a special face mask for his broken nose with tacks over top of this nose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You can so get, maybe, you can get maybe this. For.
Yeah. This is U.S. healthcare. You can
oh, yeah, this. Yeah. They offer this in Shoppers Drug Mart. Yeah,
of course. So Darby's music is playing and Matt stops the music. He wants their new theme song to start playing. So we get their Succession knockoff until Danielson yells, "Turn this shit off." And Danielson calls for the greatest music in the history of pro wrestling as Europe begins to play, and thus this became maybe the most costly main event in history, because Final Countdown begins. Whoever came up with this was amazing. For was awesome. Like 4 minutes you got, yeah, Final Countdown playing, and the crescendo hit with Darby hitting the coffin drop off the balcony. I thought these 4 minutes were just like magic. I thought it was,
oh man,
whatever this cost, it was worth it, because I thought this was awesome. They could have done another 10 minutes of this, and this audience, they were going insane during this portion of the match. And really, it just sparked them for the rest. This was a crazy match. We're talking all these hours into the match, and you cannot say that this crowd was affected from the length of this show when, yeah, they were on their feet going crazy for this.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. I mean, they had done this in prior Anarchies in the Arena with a Wild Thing, and I don't know if there were other matches where they did something similar, but like it's the New Jack, you know, gimmick where like it just kind of adds to the feeling of chaos. Like you're not really supposed to be focusing on any sort of single individual at this point in the match. Like you're just kind of supposed to absorb the entire vibe of everything going on around you at once. There's music going on that you know, it's Europe. There's Darby Allin climbing a balcony and delivering coffin drops. Like the announcers aren't able to keep track of it all, and it's all to the benefit of this like completely unorganized, beautiful mess that you're just kind of being presented with, that made it all feel very special to start off.
Yeah. How costly do you think it would be to get Natural Born Killers for a future Anarchy in the Arena?
If you want, probably not as much as Europe.
Yeah, I would think Europe is the high end for them. Mm-hmm. Matt eventually cuts this off, stating it costs $200,000 per play, and they end the music, and this crowd was livid. They were so angry that they had stopped this, and they're chanting, "We want music." But this match was just too insane for them to be too hung up about the loss of Europe. But it was like, this was going so well that I thought this crowd was going to just be so upset about the music going away. Okada lifted up a street sign that read Rainmaker Drive, and he was so proud of this street sign. Then we go to the back, and Jack Perry and Darby have fought their way to the back, and Jack Perry takes an unintended cold plunge into this giant metal container of drinks with ice. And then Jack Perry buries Darby into a pile of trash, and Jack Perry commandeers a bus and rides over this trash.
I don't know if he commandeered it, John. This looked like it was his bus because it said scapegoat on the.
You're right. This was the official Jack Perry bus that he travels with now. So this is the tour bus.
And printed scapegoat on the top so that you knew it was his.
Just in case he gets lost at the mall and he's looking for it. He doesn't have the.
Where did I park?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's the one with scapegoat.
Mine A6. Oh, I'm scapegoat. That's me. So he, you're right. This was his own custom bus. Drives over to. So we are led to believe that he is driven over top of a lifeless Darby, and then we cut to Jack Perry unconscious behind the wheel, so that he has knocked himself out from this. And that's the end of Darby Allin and Jack Perry. They had a good run. They're done.
It's, you know, a real bus, real glass,
real fire. Everything. Okay. Yeah. So that's the end of that chapter for now. And so we cut
what is,
to
what is wrestling? I ask you, John.
Well,
a man
it's,
driving a bus.
It's about selling a bus, running you over, and then it's stumbling to the ring to meet Kazuchika Okada for your comeback as Darby is alive.
I can't believe Okada was in this match. Unbelievable.
Danielson has been busted open from chairs, and he's fighting the Bucks on the poker chips, which ends with a TK driver to Danielson with Nick leaping off the stage onto a poker chip, which that alone was nuts and will be just one of many things forgotten about this match. But Jack Perry has recovered from his unconsciousness and grabs Tony Khan from the gorilla position and goes to bring him out. And there was like this time standing still moment where we didn't know where Perry and Khan had gone. We're just waiting for anyone to come out. And then we see Darby with his flamethrower coming out one tunnel. Jack Perry comes out the other tunnel with Tony Khan. And so Jack Perry is drenched, and we had seen him thrown into the water. But then are we to also believe that after the crash, he was also covered in gasoline?
I don't know if you're supposed to think that that was gasoline.
Because he ignited.
Well, could just light on fire even without gasoline, I guess, with the flame.
I feel the thought,
the
idea was that this car crash, he had gasoline on him.
That's also possible. You know, you don't know what happens in
this
crashes.
Is how deep I imagine they were thinking this. So Jack Perry is lit on fire, his lower body, and they just let this guy roast until they finally get extinguishers. This would not be the end of...
What is wrestling? John, is it a man lighting somebody else on fire with flamethrowers?
Well, they had to do this. I would say this was a satisfying utilization of the flamethrower of what you had to incorporate this in some way.
This was fucking awesome, dude. I love the way they set all this up. Okay, first of all, with the flamethrower on Wednesday, okay, to the sort of like the theater of having to have Jack Perry dunked into the ice bath so that he has an excuse for getting wet, to the bus commandeering, and then the staged car bus accident, making reference to the Darby Allin bus accident so that you could have them separated this way. And then to being Darby locked up behind the Cody Vader, and then to having Tony Khan involved so that Darby could have an excuse to use a flamethrower on Jack Perry. I thought it was all orchestrated beautifully to lead to this moment.
This was like for what it was, like really like well
done.
Laid out for
it was the best flamethrower spot I've ever seen in a wrestling match. Yeah,
easily. Yes. This beats what Triple H shooting a Kane in the face with one.
That's not a flamethrower, is it?
The Bucks proceed to remove Darby's mask, and there is a coffin drop to Okada, but the Bucks make a save, and then this buckle descends from the rafters, and they hogtie Darby Allin. This is like our Age of the Fall callback, and they hang this guy, but not before Dax shows up, and Matt connects with an exploding chair to Dax Harwood, an exploding chair. Okada then puts on a sleeve full of tacks to hit a Rainmaker to Cash, and then Okada gets some limited edition Young Bucks Reebok pumps with tacks on them, and the Bucks put on the tacks. They have elevated Darby, so he is hanging from the ceiling over top the ring, and they start super kicking him in the face in his broken nose. Danielson returns, and he's fighting off the Bucks, and the crowd starts chanting, "Please help Darby," who has been hanging upside down for a good 3-4 minutes at this point, blood rushing to his head. The announcers are trying to make sense of why he hasn't been lowered. Their answer is the production crew might be scared to defy the orders of the Young Bucks, so they are just going to let this man expire over top of this ring as this match continues. Danielson hits a running Busaiku knee with a chair to Nick. He is stopped by an Okada Rainmaker, then an EVP trigger. And as Danielson is listening to the chants of "Please help Darby," Danielson's final bit of life is reaching for Darby when Jack Perry returns and hits his running knee to Danielson and pins Bryan in 30 minutes to end Anarchy in the Arena 3.
Yeah. Let's just simmer it.
I think this visual is everything you need to know. This explains plenty.
So at this point, Anarchy in the Arena inspires just, I think, expectations of spectacle, creativity, and complete madness and chaos. And they delivered, I think, all those things. I mean, I was exhausted. I mean, I was exhausted anyway already by the end of this match. We're talking like 5.5 hours into the show. But for them to deliver a match where clearly there were no shackles other than the ones on Darby Allin's feet of what they could devise and spend money on creating, they put everything into this one. And I would say for the most part, almost everything came off really well and worked to like their imagination. It was the type of match where you just kept waiting for what they were going to, what they've created next, what surprise they were going to introduce next, whether it was, I don't know, the bus or the pumps with the thumbtacks on it, or like Darby Allin hanging, or Darby Allin with a flamethrower, or Jack Perry getting lit on fire, or an exploding set of chairs, or Tony Khan's involvement. Every time, like, they just had a million things that they were going to stack one on top of the other to make you surprised. And it just created this feeling of you continuing to wait and not being able to expect what was coming next. And it's very exciting and it's very special that they managed to, I think, continue to create that feeling for several years now with these sort of matches. So I was very impressed. I was certainly satisfied. And I definitely think this lived up to the billing and the price tag of admission.
I thought this was for what this was. It was spectacular. It was insane. I thought that this show was like, I thought the last four matches, I was very, very satisfied with these last four matches from the barbed wire cage onward. I thought all four of these matches, I was really, they to me were all the high points of this show. I'd throw in Ospreay and Roderick Strong there too. Plus you got like a really big return in MJF. So I would state that certainly the triple main event idea, I know the cage and swerve, it was, for some maybe sandwiched in there, but I thought they really held their own in a really tough spot for a match that you were trying to sell a challenger. That was a tough sell in terms of somebody that was not just your transitional challenger of the month. But yeah, this final 30 minutes was total insanity, and that's what this crowd wanted. And listen, this crowd, they were on their feet in this main event 5+ hours into this show. So I think you like the last 2 hours of this show I thought were like excellent.
Yes. Just that sentence alone I think is
the last 2 hours of this
the
show.
Last two out of the 5.5 hours is really good. Yeah, I mean, honestly, like when you just kind of look at the quality of some of the matches, including Copeland versus Malakai Black, I would also put like Deeb versus Tony Storm up there as like a match I also really enjoyed. It's value for money that I think Tony Khan is going for and that he delivers. Now, is it the type of value for money that you want to consume all in one sitting? To be a part of the conversation, I guess you kind of have to, but if somebody decided to kind of like, you know, split their viewing and decide to watch this one in parts, I also wouldn't blame them. It was overall a very good match that I think continues to maintain the high caliber of AEW pay-per-views, with really maybe one of the only criticisms being how much time it demands of you for one entire sitting.
It would be my thought, and I'm not looking for AEW to expand to two nights of pay-per-views, although please, I really don't think people should be shocked if AEW looks to do that at some point, if they're incentivized financially to do that type of thing. But in this current model, honestly, I think you could take like literally five matches in the middle of this pay-per-view, spread them out over television, and you're still delivering a kick-ass 3.5-hour pay-per-view with a ton of big stars that I think are selling the exact amount of tickets that might even look more attractive on paper from something that's a more just concise, big show feel of, you know, seven, six big matches, and you get a Moxley Takeshita on television. You get a Orange Cassidy Trent with an angle on television as well. But these are the way they're doing these pay-per-views, and they're kind of, you know, this is par for the course of what you're going to get from these AEW shows, but they are doing more of these pay-per-views now, and it's like, I would be curious of some that are, you're spending $50. You're also being asked of, like, it's a big ask of your, like, you want to get your money's worth and you want to watch the whole thing. Is it a little daunting for people?
It is. But what if you didn't spend $50?
Well, if you didn't spend $50, that would mean you have a lot of extra to pocket and you can go explore an AEW pay-per-view in any region that you so desire.
You know a lot of reasons by now why we love using NordVPN. It allows us access to geo-blocked services like AEW Plus. It helps us unlock cheaper prices for pay-per-views. But let's not forget a VPN's most important function, protecting your online privacy. If you do any sort of downloading of content, or if you regularly use Wi-Fi outside of your home, a trusted VPN helps mask your IP to protect your browsing from advertisers, hackers, and even your ISP. And while, yes, the protection of a VPN may come with slower browsing speeds, NordVPN happens to be the fastest in the game. Named CNET's fastest VPN of 2024 through their extensive speed tests, Nord clocks an average download speed loss of just 11.1%, compared to Surfshark's 17% and ExpressVPN's 24.8%. Get the protection you need from the most reputable and fastest VPN on the market for just $3 a month. Sign up through nordvpn.com/postwrestling, where listeners can get 4 bonus months on top of all 2-year plans, plus a 30-day money-back guarantee. Again, nordvpn.com/postwrestling. Get your bonus months and let them know you found Nord through us. Very well done.
Do we have any more announcements to make, Wei?
I think we might want to save the next one for tomorrow.
Should we?
Yeah, let's save it for tomorrow.
Okay. We have an announcement to make tomorrow.
It's actually already on all of our socials, so if you want to get the jump, go to @postwrestling. And you can maybe find out a bit early, but we will formally announce something tomorrow on Rwanda Raw.
Okay. Let's do some feedback. If you want to get in the super chat, you're welcome to do so with your thoughts on Double or Nothing. Do you want to start things off or shall I?
You could start, John.
We go first to Brian from New Jersey. A pay-per-view ending after midnight? I don't care. Not only am I off work tomorrow, but I was very much awake throughout. I thought this pay-per-view really delivered. I can't name a bad match on the pay-per-view. Anarchy in the Arena was the most insane match I've seen from this company, and I've seen Hangman Page drink Swerve's blood. Darby hitting the coffin drop at the end of the first verse of the final countdown killed me. Willow and Monet exceeded my expectations, even though I was hoping Willow would retain. Strong win for Swerve. Very good opener. Literal hell of a cage match. MJF's return was one of the most important things on the card, if not the most important. He's been missed, especially by AEW. Very good, newsworthy event.
We go up next to Cody from Maine, who says, fantastic pay-per-view. Could a match or two have been better served as a Dynamite or Collision main event? Perhaps, but nothing was out of place on the show. The in-ring delivered while they also established a ton moving forward. Highlight of the night, the flamethrower spot. Pun intended, they caught a lot of heat on Wednesday for using something that they would, quote, never actually use. Well, they proved those people wrong with a very safe yet spectacular spot that will be talked about for years to come.
Really? I had no doubt they were going to use this. Really?
People doubted they would figure
out a way to use a flamethrower in a match.
I mean, I just thought it was a showpiece. I didn't think that they were going to actually use it, but yeah, here we are.
And Muggin writes that Vegas is lucky that it's a long weekend. Double or Nothing had several standout high points. MJF returned to squash the abysmal Devil Saga. Mercy and Willow was dope. Copeland and Malachi was wild. Anarchy in the Arena was like a hurricane in a living room. And Swerve Cage got the job done to cement Swerve as world champion. A lot of matches were marred by overbooking, and the Owen Cup got added stakes for Wembley with a title shot waiting for the winners. Why wasn't this the case from the start? Well, it's the case now, Muggins. So even the Royal Rumble winner didn't always get a title shot. So eventually.
Yeah. I mean, last year they were doing Cole versus MJF, and I guess who won? Like, it was Cole that won. Wait, who?
Did no,
Cole
last won year. Last year, last year was Willow and Ricky Starks won last year.
You're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it was Cole the previous year that it won.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
All right. Well, that is Double or Nothing in the books. It is way too late to be talking about wrestling, but we have made it to the end way. My apologies.
It's not your fault. There is a lot going on and it's very late. You have nothing to apologize for. The show went off without a hitch. Perfect.
Okay. Perfect. Well, Way and I are now going to take a week off. We'll be back Monday night, right after Raw, 3 hours of Raw from Savannah, Georgia.
Yeah. Yeah. It never ends. That is professional wrestling. That's why we all love it. You know, there's always something to watch, something to talk about. If you happen to like these shows, if you want to listen to the show ad free, maybe a bit too late for you now. You sat through all these ads. But the next time we do one of these, if you want to sit through it ad free, consider signing up at postwrestlingcafe.com. That's our Patreon, where we also have a bunch of bonus shows up in the cafe right now. We have a review of Collision, which I guess at this point is a bit outdated, but if you want to go back and listen to it, that's fine. It'll be there next week as well. Rewind to SmackDown. Also, reviews of our MCU later, talking about X-Men this month. Rewind Away, talking about WWE Extreme Rules from 2012. A lot of great stuff up there if you want to support the channel.
All right, check out all of that great stuff. And yes, we'll have an announcement on Monday, but you can get a sneak peek on our socials if you are so inclined. That's it for us. Good night. Goodbye.